This year, the European Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, better known as CBAM, enters its implementation phase. Starting at 2.5%, the mechanism will be gradually phased in over the next 9 years. But as it moves from theory to practice, important questions are emerging, such as, is the mechanism fit for purpose? How effective is its current design? And what will its complexity mean in practice for countries, importers, and producers? To unpack these issues, I had a conversation with two experts at the heart of the discussion. Jostein Roynesdal, Vice President and Head of Group EU Affairs, Group Communication and Public Affairs at Hydro, and Hélène Lefray, Government Affairs Leader, Europe for Climate and Energy at Dow. While both Jostein and Hélène raise questions about CBAM's current design and its potential impact on European industry, they also remain cautiously optimistic about what the mechanism could ultimately achieve. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Jostein, Hélène, thank you so much for joining me today. We're talking about a really complicated topic, and I really appreciate the fact that you are going to break it down for us and hopefully bring some clarity in this complex landscape. So I think before we delve in too far into those complexities, I'd like to ask, what exactly is CBAM and who does it impact? So Jostein, let's start with you.
Okay. When I get that question, and it's, I give one answer, I try to be a bit provocative. So I'm saying it's a tariff. First and foremost, it affects European business and consumers. Okay, so there's a lot of writing about CBAM, what it is, how it works, who it affects. But in essence, like, it's a tax on imported products, which is usually known as a tariff. The big difference between CBAM and a normal tariff is how you calculate it. Like, a normal tariff would be 10%, 20% based on the value of the product. But CBAM is more complicated in the way that it calculates the tariff. So it's you have to trace back the emissions upward in the value chain. And then based on that, you multiply it with the CO2 price in Europe, and you get the size of the tariff. Now, who does it affect? And it is mostly European businesses, because it is the European importer that pays the CBAM fee, same as European producers pay the ETS cost, and either directly when you emit or downstream when the cost is passed through the value chain. What CBAM and ETS do in parallel is to create a high price area in Europe where sort of the premium that is created by the ETS and CBAM is a tax. It's collected as a tax. And it doesn't directly affect third country producers. I mean, if I'm a producer of aluminium in China, for example, or India, and I'm selling to the European market, I have no incentive to give a rebate on the product because I know that the importer will import, he will pay the tax, and he will sell in the European market where there's a higher price where he can recuperate the tax. So outside, businesses outside Europe, they will keep selling to Europe. The big difference is that the importer will look for the product that has the lowest carbon footprint or the lowest calculated carbon footprint. This is a big difference because there are a lot of different variations on how to calculate carbon footprint. So the real essence of CBAM is to get that right. And then he will look for that because the lower the carbon footprint, the higher the margin he can get because he gets lower tax, but he gets the same price in the European area. That's my short answer.
That's your short answer. Indeed. I'm sure we could take an entire podcast on just explaining CBAM. But I want to ask you as well, Hélène, you know, when we were preparing for this podcast, we spoke a lot about the design of CBAM. And I'd like you to both weigh in on this because I know that you both feel quite strongly about certain aspects of the design. Hélène,
What are your thoughts on the current design, the challenges, the positives? What are your thoughts?
So for the moment, I mean, we are in organic chemicals and polymers business. And for the moment, organic chemicals and polymers are not in the scope of CBAM. So at the beginning, we saw CBAM as a concept, as an opportunity to level the carbon cost level playing field, because that would allow us to pass through at least some of the ETS cost, which is something we cannot do at the moment. But of course, the characteristic of the chemical sector and Dow is that we are a very complex industry with very diverse feedstocks, many different production paths, and you will find chemicals in relatively small quantities, but in pretty much every product you can buy, be it in packaging, infrastructure, consumer care, mobility application, buildings, so everywhere really. So for us, the big risk is the risk of circumvention, because the moment you stop CBAM in a value chain, you will have a circumvention after that cutoff, largely downstream. So if you stop at intermediate, you will import final product, for instance, but it can also happen upstream. So for us as a sector, it would be really crucial that we adopt basically an all or nothing approach, and that the coverage starts at the refineries with the feedstock to the end products. At the moment, we already see the impact of a partial coverage because ammonia and hydrogen are in scope. And ammonia and hydrogens are building blocks of intermediates. So let's be technical a little bit. Aniline and MDI, which are intermediates for the polyurethane value chain. And polyurethane, you will find that in many products. It's the foam in mattresses, in seating, in footwear, or installation, for instance. And because of that very partial coverage, we see an impact in cost of what we import. We have to pay the associated CBAM cost on ammonia and hydrogen and the loss of free allocation, but we cannot pass it through. And they are very concerned that trade patterns will shift to circumvent CBAM, either downstream or even upstream.
Yostein, would you like to comment as well?
Yes, thank you. When we look at the shortcomings of CBAM, there are two ways you can go. And one is the practical route, because what we're trying to do with CBAM in Europe is to take a system we've had with ETS for 20 years and that we've refined over and over again. You have big installations, big factories that are reporting every year, and you have third-party verification. And then we are trying to extend that to products that are being imported, thousands and thousands of product categories, and apply to the rest of the world. And that makes it infinitely more complex than the ETS. So there will be a lot of practical challenges in getting the reporting to work and getting the verification to work, and getting the reporting systems in place. So that is one thing. The other thing that we are mostly preoccupied with is how it affects the market price. Because in the end, that is what will determine if it is effective or not. The problems that arise with CBAM is because basically have two different ways of paying for carbon costs. In the European Union, you have ETS on big installations, and this creates a sort of carbon premium in the market that you should be able to pass on to the customer. So the price formation is more organic. It's market-based when you come down the value chain. With CBAM, it's a regulatory instrument, right? And so where the price level is determined by a tax methodology. So the problem here is that the tax methodology currently is not matching the market price formation in the European Union for all aluminium products. For the most basic ones, basic primary aluminium, it is pretty straightforward that, you know, they're able to do that. But when it comes to down the value chain, it becomes more complicated. And this has to do with the role of recycled aluminium in the value chain. Because if you take any type of aluminium product you have, like in your iPhone, there's 25 grams of aluminium. And your window frames, they're probably made of aluminium if you're in an office or you have ceilings or you have a car park. Statistically, 50% of that has at some point been aluminium scrap, either collected as a, you know, it's been used before it had a life. It was a can, it was a window, it was a car. And then it's been collected and circled back, or a large chunk of it, more than half of all the scrap, is what we call industrial scrap. So it's cut off in the production process. And because aluminium is a great material, you can recycle it infinitely in principle. So it's all circled back from the factory, remelted and pushed out again. The problem with CBAM is it says all those volumes, which amount to half of global aluminium volumes annually, they don't have any carbon footprint in CBAM. Hence, you have no CBAM fee for that aluminium. But so this is one thing, like this is the effect on the border. But if you look at how this plays out in the European market, aluminium is a commodity with a global reference price. And in Europe, we will have what we call a carbon premium on top of that because of ETS and CBAM. And that premium will permeate through the value chain and all products, including aluminium scrap, because it is an interchangeable commodity with primary aluminium. So you will have high cost for all aluminium products in Europe, including the recycled ones. But the recycled ones that come from outside Europe will not have that cost. So we've done an analysis with a consultancy, and their estimation is that if this problem is not fixed, we risk to lose a third of all European aluminium recyclers by 2035. It's a big issue for us. And the aluminium industry is aligned. So the fix is quite simple. It is to just say all aluminium products that are imported should have the same carbon cost. You should have a system that mirrors the European carbon premium. But currently, it doesn't. Now, in the revised proposal from the Commission, they said, okay, let's include the industrial scrap, which is about half of it. And that closes half the loophole. But still, there's an enormous volume that is left, and you still have the problem of false declarations, which we definitely think will be a problem. Our intention or our ask to the Parliament and the Council and the Commission at this point is to just close it, and we'll see if it can be effective. But if they don't, you won't have that level playing field that we're looking for, unfortunately. So this is the main issue for us.
Helene, I'd like to ask you, what are the key changes that we can expect to see this year with implementation?
For us, it will be still limited because I've explained that partial coverage we are getting sort of dragged into, which I think was unintended consequences of having ammonia and hydrogen in scope. But definitely, we expect to see a cost impact already as of 2026. Like I said, our suppliers are passing through this additional cost downstream. And the impact is especially difficult because the intermediate products as such do not have to pay that extra fee. So they can be imported without having to pay the fee. So we don't have we create an uneven level playing field in the value chain like polyurethane that will have ammonia and hydrogen somewhere in the value chain, in our case, to make intermediate building blocks. We have estimated already that for such a small partial coverage, the additional cost for the all EU MDI industry is between 33 and 48 million per year, only because ammonia is in. That will certainly increase over time. And that makes us very worried if the design of CBAM is not correct in going further in the event of an extension to the chemical sector, and to what extent. it would probably mean that we would face competition from the outside, and you would get imports that do not face the carbon cost imported into the EU. And so we need to ensure that there is a level playing field. It will otherwise severely further undermine the competitiveness of the chemical sector in Europe. And now, our complexity is extremely high. That's probably something that was underestimated in general when CBAM, you know, was put together and proposed. And we will face methodology issues. At the moment, there is no agreed industry methodology, not in Europe, not internationally, beyond what we have under the EU ETS. So it will be extremely complex to translate that down to the product level. And of course, we see that other countries have their own way of approaching those things. They have different methodologies. Verification will be an important element, because you will have to be able to trust the information that comes from third countries.
Helen, you raised so many good points there. And I think I want to drill down into some of them, because you touched on the verification. You know, how difficult will this be to implement, to manage, to verify? I mean, like you say, it's highly complicated. Justine, what are your thoughts on this?
The verification thing will definitely be a big practical challenge. I'm not aware if there are enough verifiers globally, but CBAM actually stipulates that for verifications, for some of them, you have to do physical on-site checks. So you could say, in a way, there's a lot of work for verifiers and consultants in CBAM, definitely. When it comes to this year, I think what we would have wanted to see was learning, because Ellen touched upon it. CBAM is being phased in gradually. So it's 2.5% less free allocation this year, 5% next year with its small CBAM top up. So Platts, the commodity firm, they released a couple of days ago an estimate that's saying the CBAM premium for aluminium in Europe will be $38 in 2026. That's what they assume. And this is about 1.5% of the basic aluminium price. So it's not extremely high. It's a shame, though, that, you know, the reporting of emissions from the importers, you don't have to buy certificates until next year. So this year, we won't have any data yet. We would have liked to have this period to have like live data that could show us, what do the importers do? Do they change their buying pattern? What is the impact on the premium? But we won't know that until another year, at least. This is a result of how CBAM is designed, that they delayed the reporting requirements for 2026. So we're actually focusing more on the political side of it to get the CBAM design right in the parliament and the council. And hopefully we can learn more about the actual impact next year. Now, our market teams are monitoring constantly what is happening with the premiums and market, so we can make some assumptions. But I would wish that data was more available so we could have a sort of common learning from trying to phase it in, because it is important to use this first period to see what is actually happening in the market. And how does it work effectively? Can we change something? And so that's what I assume for this year, at least.
Thanks, Justine. I would like to touch on the issue of global trade just for a moment. And Helen, you touched on it when you said different countries are obviously moving at a different pace and there's different methodologies being employed. So if on a global level, the complexity really just increases exponentially. But besides that, this could obviously impact global trade.
Yes. Yeah, so I already mentioned that we fear that there will be a shift in trade patterns. Not only that, but probably they will shift in a way to maximize circumvention. I'm a little bit concerned. I mean, I have yet to look at all the text the Commission has issued in December, but their focus for the downstream extension, for instance, seems one of the aspects seems to be the trade intensity. But that may poorly reflect the impact we will feel after an extension if those patterns shift as a consequence of a poorly designed CBAM, for instance. What we see also is that CBAM is at the heart of trade discussions nowadays. The US last summer identified it as a non-tariff barrier to trade. You'll still say it was a tax. So in the trade deal last summer, the European Commission had agreed with the US to offer more flexibility, which is basically the agreed simplification measures that were adopted at the end of last year. I think one concern the US had in particular was the impact on SMEs. You also just concluded a trade agreement with India, and during those talks, as is reported in the press, that India had threatened retaliatory measures in relation to CBAM. So now both sides will enter into a dialogue, and Brussels already pledged not to favor any of its other partners over India. So I think this is bound to increase, and we will see that emerging or continuing in various discussions with our trade partners. And there are also discussions in terms of methodology taking place, or that will take place most likely during COP30 last year. Brazil launched the Open Coalition on Compliance Carbon Markets that was with the European Union, but also China, Canada, Chile, Mexico, Zambia, Rwanda. There are others. It's not an exhaustive list. Though a kind of climate club, really. Because they want to have this ambition about carbon markets. But interestingly, it does include issues related to CBAM, but also carbon footprint methodology. So I would say watch this space.
Will this have an impact in terms of electricity?
I guess you're referring to the fact that CBAM applies to electricity. I think for electricity, there will first and foremost be some practical issues with the EU-UK connection, EU-Norway, actually, because Norway will implement CBAM, but they're a little bit delayed. Now, there's no carbon in the electricity coming from Norway. It's all hydropower and wind power, so it's probably not going to be a big deal. But to my knowledge, the EU doesn't import that much electricity. I mean, there's some in the south, the import from Russia has been shut off. So it's a bit of a, to me, the fact that electricity was included as a good was a bit strange, because there's not much import to talk about when it comes to electricity. So the impact will not be enormous. I think the big impact is emissions from electricity embedded in goods. When you talk about indirect emissions, that is sort of the big question, at least for aluminium. And, you know, we have a different view than other sectors. Aluminium does not see it as beneficial to include indirect emissions. And that, again, has to do with how CBAM and the market prices or passes on carbon cost. And it has to do with the structure of the global aluminium market as well. So where it is produced, under using what kind of electricity source. Like, is it coal? Is it gas? Is it hydropower? Is it nuclear? This will be very important for how it actually works.
I know back when CBAM was adopted, electricity was also an issue because of the import from third countries into the EU with a higher CO2 footprint. But I don't know what these exchanges are nowadays. But emissions are also important for us. And contrary to Jostein, I think in the chemical sector, we would like to have the indirect emission in scope, because in particular downstream in our value chain, that's where the bulk of emissions come from electricity consumption.
We've really touched on several different aspects here of CBAM. And obviously, this is a highly complex situation that we're dealing with. But in theory, in principle, do you believe that CBAM will eventually achieve what it's set out to achieve? Helen, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, I said at the beginning, we were rather positive towards the concept of CBAM. Now, of course, the situation, the economic situation, the geopolitical situation, everything is so much more different. To be honest, at the moment, without a design that would address all the issues we have, we would rather stick for maintaining the free allocation of ETS, which we see still as the most effective and viable solution to mitigate carbon leakage. And it's very acute at the moment because the impact of carbon cost is actually pretty high on our competitiveness. But I would say that it seems that the EU is sticking to the original plan for now. So ultimately, we may be covered by CBAM. I don't know when exactly. And internally, we continue to work on that and to ensure that in that event, we would guess the best design possible. And we're also keeping an eye on the international developments, on the methodology development. But I think it's very important that we don't rush into something that has not proven to be effective. And that fortunately, the first sectors in scope will build that experience for us. And like I said, we will also partially get that experience because we've been involuntarily impacted by CBAM already. But to be cautious and effective in what is designed will be very important.
Cautiously optimistic. Indeed, and especially at a time when industrial competitiveness is so important to Europe. Jostein, would you like to weigh in?
Yeah. So the question of will it work? That's what you're getting at, right? Because the principle is good. So we have a carbon cost in Europe. We should apply that to imported products as well, and so that it's equal. And if that happens, then it is effective. And then for industry, then it's a viable instrument. We have to acknowledge, though, that this is a pricing mechanism and it will increase cost for end consumers. So all end products will go up in price, depending on the input material. Now, that is the theory. The best case in theory is a zero-sum game for the industry, right? So you have increased ETS cost that we have to pay, and then the importers will pay the same. That means that we can pass that cost on to the next part of the value chain. So if it's effective 100%, then the net sum for us will be zero. So anything that is not best case is a net loss for the European industry. And that's where it gets tricky, right? We as a company, we're in favor of carbon leakage tools that work. Right now, the current design of CBAM, we don't think it's there yet. But look at what are the options here. The whole design of the ETS and the free allowances is based on the premise that free allocation will be phased out eventually, and they have to. And at some point, the allowances will drop to zero. If industry has to pay for all the allowances, all the emissions, then you have to have some sort of mechanism that protects it, that tries to equate that carbon cost for other products. If it's a CBAM or another mechanism, I don't know what could be the alternative, but if we have that premise that free allocation will be phased out eventually, then you have to have a sort of mirroring mechanism. And that's why we're trying to work to make CBAM as effective as possible to see if that mechanism can actually be the solution. Like I said, right now, it's not great. Luckily, we have a couple of years now to make it better, to make it stronger, and to make it work more in favor of European industry and not non-European industry. So I think that's my answer. It remains to be seen.
Helen, you wanted to weigh in?
Yes, I just wanted to add that, of course, CBAM is a very important element to allow that cost pass through. And I think the big untouched element in the climate policy is that ultimately, customers will have to pay the price of the transition. We cannot absorb it because we face international competition. And that's something that has to be more clearly spelled out. But we risk being caught a little bit between a rock and a hard place, because the other element of the ETS is that at the moment, because we do not have the enabling conditions to decarbonize as an industry, for instance, CCS, we are facing a real risk of deindustrialization. That's the signal we are receiving. You increase the price, but if we don't have the tools we need to decarbonize our processes, eventually that will lead to closures. So carbon leakage is very important. We need to be able to address that. And that means at the moment, keeping free allocation, probably getting more free allocation, because as long as we cannot decarbonize, there is no way forward for us.
Very thought-provoking words, Helene, indeed. Obviously, we are just touching the tip of the iceberg on this very convoluted topic, but I believe that both of you will be speaking at an event that's coming up, European Industrial Energy Days, which is taking place on the 4th and 5th of March in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. So obviously you'll be delving into more detail in your panel discussion. Jostein, what are you hoping to emphasize in your time at the event?
That we need to rush a few things. We need to rush to quickly address the shortcomings of CBAM. What we don't have to rush is expanding and expanding and expanding. Some products have to be included, but what is really important right now is that with the emission scope that we have, that we manage to cement CBAM and make it, what do we say, watertight, or to make it effective for the parts that are covered. And then have a look at, say, does it work? Are we able to create this kind of carbon leakage protection by taxing imported products? If we are, then yes, maybe we should go ahead with it. So that is, I think, my main point in the panel will be that there are certain fixes that need to be made very quickly.
Helene, you will obviously be speaking in the same panel. What would your message be?
So I'm very much looking forward to it. I'll meet Jostein in person. So yes, I think a very cautious approach when it comes to our sector with CBAM. We need to get this right, and they will be very complex. We'll be happy to give our input into the more technical discussions, and probably to find some sort of compensation for the unintended impact we are already experiencing at the moment, which is cost for us. And also because the topic generally is ETS and CBAM, really we are very concerned about the signals we are receiving from the ETS at the moment, and we think we need really, as the review is expected later this year, to look at how it is impacting industry and to potentially redesign ETS so that it helps us decarbonize and not deindustrialize.
Well, I would encourage our listeners to attend the event and listen to that panel. I'm sure it's going to be really interesting. For now, we are unfortunately out of time. This has just been very thought-provoking, and I wish we could go into more detail, because I feel like, as I said, this is just the tip of the iceberg. But Jostein, Helene, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us here. Glad to contribute.
Wonderful. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Log, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.